Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an attempt to understand Donald Trump's outrageous and unsupported smear of President Obama in an historical context, since calling your predecessor a bad or sick guy seems almost unprecedented in its crudeness and lack of dignity. Princeton historian Sean Wilentz, the author of The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, whose latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians, joins us to discuss the pre-dawn flurry of tweets from Trump accusing Obama of Nixon Watergate tapping of his phones in Trump Tower. And now the call by the Trump administration for a congressional investigation into these charges, which appear to be based on Breitbart News conspiracies and the musings of a right-wing talk radio host for which no evidence has been forthcoming. Then we will examine further the apparent attempt to deflect the press's focus away from the continuing breaking news of more evidence of the Trump campaign's involvement with Russian officials, and speak with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. We will explore the irony that the current dictator in Cambodia, Hun Sen, is using Donald Trump's attacks on the press and accusations of fake news as a way to justify this former Khmer Rouge functionary's crackdown on the press and the jailing of opposition politicians. Then finally, we will speak with Alistair Smith, a professor of politics at New York University who has extensively researched the nature of dictatorship and other forms of bad leadership. He is the author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics, and his latest book is The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. We will discuss how Donald Trump fits into the global pantheon of dictators, despots, and authoritarians who unfortunately make up the majority of leaders around the world who exploit and oppress their beleaguered citizens. And joining us now is Sean Wilentz, who is the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. His books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. His latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Wilentz.
Great to be here again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Sean. And what do you make of this flurry of tweets that took place a few days ago on March the 4th, well, yesterday, as a matter of fact?
Yeah.
I just want to quickly read them for the benefit of, because they're brief. But the point being that the first one was at 3:35 a.m., and that is, terrible, just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism. Then at 3:49, is it legal for a sitting president to be wiretapping a race for president prior to an election turned down by court earlier? A new low. And then at 4:02 a.m., how low has President Obama gone to tap my phones? Tap is misspelled. My phones during the very sacred election process. This is Nixon Watergate, bad or sick guy. That last bit, it really, when you say beyond the pale, I know the bar's been lowered, but where, how does it strike you?
Yeah, I mean, no, I can't think of an American president who said quite that much about a previous president. But at any rate, look, it seems to me that Trump is picking up on a report that appeared on Breitbart News, which was also spread around by one of the right-wing talk hosts, and it was actually repeating a charge that came out or a report that came out some months ago that a FISA court warrant had been obtained to tap to investigate the Trump campaign's connections with the Russians, the Trump campaign that was still going on at that point. Whether that report is true or not is unclear. It hasn't been cleared up. I heard James Clapper today deny that a FISA court warrant had ever been issued, but you know, who knows? But that's what Trump is picking up on now. You know, either the report is sort of true, this would not be a case of President Obama having tapped his phones. It would be a case of the FBI and the CIA and the NSA tapping his phones, not the President of the United States. Either that is true or it's not true. If it's true, Well, then, that's interesting because, first of all, Donald Trump will have just revealed it, which means that any report about leaks about this could not be prosecuted. But what it means is that the FBI, the CIA, all of these agencies would have lots of information about possible connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians. If it's not true, then the president is guilty of an extraordinary offense, which is not a legal offense, but an attack on the president of the United States making up something that's completely phony.
Well, the original, from what I recall, the original revelation about the FISA warrant came from Louise Mensch, former Tory MP from the UK, who I think is married to a rock and roll manager, lives here in the United States, and has up until recently was funded by Rupert Murdoch, a website called Heat Street. She mentioned the first that this was the third attempt to get a FISA warrant. First two were turned down by the judges. The third one, she said, was named four people, one of whom was Trump. I think that was also perhaps to some extent verified by the BBC later. But then other people have said, no, the third warrant, the reason they got the third FISA warrant was that they dropped the names and just went after the Alpha Bank and the SVB Bank servers, which are the Russian banks that the assumption is that. By the way, this is the thing that I find extraordinary. When you consider that the Russians clearly hacked the DNC, but they also got Podesta's email, and it later showed up on WikiLeaks, isn't it logical that if the Russians were working with Trump, that they would have given him the information from John Podesta's in real time, because that would be reading Hillary Clinton's mail and therefore be an enormous advantage in the race? Do you think that that is where the possibility of these communications lies?
You mean that the Russians were just feeding this stuff directly to the Trump campaign?
That's where the material is most valuable. I mean,
I think that they were also, I don't know what the Russians were doing. I mean, to get it out and expose it, I think, was to embarrass the Democrats, and that was apparently what they were trying to do. I don't know how much the Trump campaign could have capitalized directly on what, showed up on Assange's, website. I think it was an attempt to try and, screw around with American democracy in Trump's favor.
No, but I'm talking about when they first got the hack into Podesta, not the DNC.
Right.
That would have given the real customer for that would be Trump, wouldn't it? I mean, it makes sense.
I guess. I don't know how much they were getting off of Podesta, except, we read those emails. It's pretty...
It's pretty pedestrian, I know.
Yeah, and there's nothing in there. What it shows is turf fighting inside the Clinton campaign more than anything else, and, people are already measuring for drapes inside the Oval and inside the, the West Wing. I don't know that there would have been much of value there. It was much more effective, I think, in being embarrassing to the Clinton people. The stuff about Sanders that they got from the DNC, all of that. I mean, they were able to blow that up and make her look bad. So I don't know that I don't know if I follow that one, Ian. What I am getting, though, is this question of, again and again and again, the Trump seems to be getting more and more desperate to shut this investigation down. And the Republicans are still putting up a fight to try and shut this investigation down, but they're beginning to wear down a little bit. And, the thing this week with Jeff Sessions was part of that. When you think where we were a week ago, it reminds me a bit of the Watergate business in that at the end of any week, if you would imagine where you were at the end of the week, at the beginning of the week, people would have thought you were crazy. But things are developing very fast. And again, it's this drip, drip, drip where people are saying one thing and then they have to take it back. And that's what we're seeing so far. And I think that's driving Trump crazy. I mean, there was a report, I think it was on ABC, about him going, ballistic just before he went off for his weekend, ballistic at the fact that Sessions had to recuse himself. And, he takes this, he thinks they should order people about and they should do what they're told to do. Well, that's not the way it works in the presidency of the United States.
Well, he particularly apparently went ballistic on McGahn, his White House counsel.
The counsel, exactly.
Yeah, but then, interesting enough, it was the counsel, the White House counsel, the same person that Trump dressed down, who's come up with this ridiculous idea that the Congress should investigate these charges that he's made against President Obama, for which there's been no evidence proffered. Right. So,
well, I mean, you know, he's, I suspect he's trying to divert in order to keep his, you know, the president's, you know, good graces. You know, it's another way to try to another smoke screen.
And again, I'm speaking with Sean Mullins, who's a George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University, where he has taught since 1979. His books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. And his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. Well, it does. It's pretty clear that Donald Trump has developed or constructed a firewall to try and contain this Russian story, with Sessions at the DOJ as the AG, with Pompeo with the CIA, with Dan Coats at the DNI, with Senator Burr at the House Senate Intel Committee, and Devin Nunes at the House Intel Committee. So, and we can see the major crack, of course, being now with Sessions. So, what's your sense then of how this battle is shaping up in the shadows?
I think that I think the Sessions recusal was a big hit to Donald Trump. I mean, he's not going to resign, but the fact now is that that's now in the hands of the Deputy Attorney General. We'll see what the Deputy Attorney General does. The Deputy Attorney General is not, to say the least, not a Trump person. And you know, really, it's the most important of that group was the Attorney General, and so, with that having been undone so quickly, so rapidly, you know, it was a big hit. We'll see where it goes on from here. But I think you're right. I mean, the fact that the Republicans won the Senate meant that there was going to be this opportunity for him to build this firewall. These people were there, not Pompeo, but Burr was there certainly before he was elected. So he's playing his, you know, all the cards that he's got. But this story is so big. There are so many moving parts to it. There were so many different layers to it that it's very, very hard to contain, even if you have your people there. And then, of course, you know, Donald Trump is his own worst enemy. I mean, the more he does his tweeting, the more that this stuff comes out, the worse he looks. He's making trouble for himself. So it's a bit exhausting, but there's a lot more that's going to be going on here, I think.
Well, in terms of the political polarity and polarization in this country, this whole story of the Russian or the alleged Russian interference in the elections has thrown so much on its head. You've got right-wing conservatives normally who have been cold warriors,
right,
and anti-Russian and anti-Soviet making excuses for Trump. And then you've got left-wingers who have always castigated U.S. intelligence as an enemy of civil liberties. They openly supported Edward Snowden, called him a hero. But now they are turning to our intelligence officers as though they're the saviors of our democracy.
Wow. Yes and no. I mean, I think there's a split on the left. I mean, there's a split between, let's say, I don't know, Senator Sanders, for example, has been very, very tough on the Russians and very, very tough on the Trump administration's possible collusion. But then there's what I call the alt-left. And, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who are very angry at the liberals who are going after Trump on the Russian connection. I mean, I think at The Nation magazine, if you read Jacobin magazine, if you read around, the alt-left is kind of taking a line not unlike that of Putin and like that of the Trump administration. So it's even more complicated. This really has thrown things into a tizzy.
Well, it's definitely, I've been getting a lot of hate mail from that, from the RT watchers.
Yes, exactly. And RT. The RT left. That's another way to put it.
Right. But that's almost incomprehensible, because Putin, if you're a leftist, Putin is a right-wing thug. I mean, he's about as far right as you'd ever get in the American political context. And of course, he has all of those trappings of a religious right zealot in our context here. I can't think of anybody. Rick Santorum is mild by comparison.
Well, it's true. I agree with you, Ian. But then you'd have to direct your question to, you know, my old colleague at Princeton, friend Steve Cohen, who has taken a very, very hard line, if not pro-Putin, then at least certainly saying that this is a kind of red-baiting that's going on against Trump. And you see the same things out there on the left. In part, I think there's a Russophilia that's out there, but it's also a feeling that, look, anything that the CIA is for, we're against, and that's a reflex reaction on the left that comes up again and again and again. And RT plays to that. I mean, the Russians are very clearly playing to that. They played to that in the Snowden business. I mean, you know, they made Snowden out to be a hero. In precisely the ways that the American leftists would like to see him as a hero. But, you know, the man's in Moscow, and he's, to my mind, he's pretty much a cover-up for a Soviet operation, even though he himself may not realize that. But that's beside the point. The point is Putin is very, very adept at tapping into certain kinds of, what should we say, reflexes, predilections, feelings, emotions on the what we'll call the RT left. It is very, very effective.
But just to sort of pull back and look at this current situation with the drip of information, yeah. And we've learned from the New York Times that obviously Obama throughout the election did not speak out against what the Russians were doing, which is a little mystifying.
Yeah.
Well, I've also learned recently that Hillary Clinton herself blames her own staff, Jake Sullivan and Podesta, for not letting her know about the full scope of what the Russians were up to. They kept that from her because they thought they were going to win. And she's, in retrospect, said had she known, she would have absolutely made an issue out of it.
Right.
Obviously, Obama, after the elections, thought, my God, what's happened, and dispersed this intelligence in such a way that it would make it more difficult for Trump to scrub it all. But that scrubbing is underway. Nunez, by the way, is sending all of our spies to the Azores.
Yes, I know.
to get them out of the way.
Yeah, right.
This is this idiot shill that at the House Intel Committee, who told the press that if they report on Russia, then they should be investigated.
Yes.
But the point I'd like to make, or at least run by you, Sean, is that at this point it looks as if Putin holds all the cards, because whatever happens with this story, the person who holds all the cards and has all the evidence is Putin himself. So doesn't that put Putin in the catbird seat in this entire situation? In fact, that's the very reason why people are concerned about conflicts of interest and why they wanted Trump's tax returns revealed, simply because you need to know who it is that could possibly have leverage over the president of the United States. And now it seems obvious to me that Vladimir Putin has enormous leverage over Trump.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're right. The one person who knows everything is Vladimir Putin. The person who knows the most is Vladimir Putin. But, you know, here I go back to the Steele dossier. You know, remember the dossier that caused so much, furor over the release of Trump's supposed sexual hanky-panky. That was the least of that dossier. What that dossier shows is that the Kremlin itself is not so monolithic, that there are cracks. I mean, the fact that you're seeing so many suspicious bodies turning up, right, of people involved with Soviet intelligence, tells me that Putin obviously is running the show, but it's a show that can get out of control on that side as well. So it's unclear to me that anybody is in total control of the situation. It's very rare in any kind of historical situation where someone is in total control. I don't think he holds all the cards. I think he's got his own reasons to be paranoid about his own people, some of whom are obviously tipping off Christopher Steele. And the more that comes out, there are leaks everywhere, is really what I'm saying. There's obviously a civil war going on inside the FBI. About getting stuff out or covering stuff up. I suspect the same thing is going on everywhere. When you get a scandal like this, there aren't clear lines, and everybody has to be watching out for what's going on around him or under him or her. By the same token, I think you're right. I mean, I think Putin has a great deal of leverage over Trump, and we'll just see how long that can last.
Well, just in closing then, Sean Mullins, Putin and the Siloviki, his cronies, mostly from the former KGB,
right,
are all essentially the oligarchs looting the country. He kind of regulates them, apparently takes kickbacks. At least you look at the most recent video from Navalny, the opposition leader. It's pretty shocking how much money Medvedev has squirreled away, let alone how much money Putin has. So you know what these guys are up to. They just want to hold on to power to keep stealing. But they've stolen so much now that Russia's falling apart and the sanctions are hurting. And the one thing that could rescue Putin is a rise in the price of oil. And that's the thing that gets me worried, because I'm hearing rumors from JSOC that there's a plan afoot to have a little war with Iran. And of course, if the Straits of Hormuz are closed, boom, the price of oil goes through the ceiling and Putin gets rescued.
Yes, well, you know more about this than I do. But there's, there's obviously a lot more levers that can be pulled and things can be distracted. People worry about Trump, starting some sort of military conflict. I mean, I think the chances of Putin doing that are much greater.
No, but I'm talking about Trump starting a little war.
Well, you mean Trump doing it? Well, yes, it could happen. You know, either way it could happen. Sure. I mean, these things are all possible. It's just why you have to get to these things as quickly as possible and as forcefully as possible. And as I said before, if you had told me a week ago the news that we're talking about this week, I would have been very surprised. So maybe it's a race to the end of the game, but we'll see.
Well, Sean Mullins, I thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you as ever, Ian. See you later.
See you later. And again, I've been speaking with Sean Mullins, who's the George Henry Davis 1886 Professor of American History at Princeton University. His books include The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, The Age of Reagan, A History, 1974 to 2008, and Bob Dylan in America. And his latest book is The Politicians and the Egalitarians. We're going to take a brief station break and be back further examining the apparent attempt to deflect the press's focus away from the continuing breaking news of more evidence of the Trump campaign's involvement with Russian officials.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And in the introduction, which you didn't hear, Roger, I mentioned in the context of you resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia, that there is a current irony out there that the Cambodian dictator Hun Sen, who's been around for over 30 years, is using Donald Trump's attacks on the press and accusations of fake news as a way to justify this former Khmer Rouge functionary's crackdown on the press and the jailing of opposition politicians. You know, he just narrowly won the last rigged elections. So isn't that ironic?
It is, quite. I must say, unlikely allies. It's rather shocking, actually, to see that this many years later, given the history of what happened to that country. And but I think we should prepare ourselves, Ian, for echoes and sort of untoward repercussions like this to come from the Trump performance. The world is watching here, as we have been reminded very often. We were reminded of that during the campaign. It's been a shameful and embarrassing interlude, but in the long run, of course, it could have much more serious results than simply damage to our reputation.
So what do you make then of this? Do you think that this charge of Trump's following these rather bizarre and extremely, I think, disgraceful tweets attacking Obama, We were just talking with a Princeton historian about this, how almost unprecedented they are. You have to go back to the early days of the Republic before you get to anything that's remotely as poisonous. But subsequent to these early morning tweets, and frankly, when you read the timeline on those tweets starting at about 3 in the morning and ending at 4 in the morning, you get a kind of mental image of this kind of Shakespearean character Macbeth or King Lear wandering around in his bathrobe in the East Wing alone, bumping into the walls, fuming at everything, real and imaginary. So that's in itself pretty extraordinary. And then on top of that, they turn around and now try and deflect everything by saying that they're calling for a congressional investigation into these completely imaginary and unsupported accusations.
I think this is a desperate measure on his part, but then again, that may be giving it too much purpose and coherence. This is a tortured personality under these circumstances, and I'm not sure that we can expect anything better or anything different in the days and weeks to come. The pressure is going to mount on this issue, and he can only evade and deflect for a time. I don't think that this is going to stick in any significant sense, because there are too many authorities out there. Clapper, of course, has already come out and said, "I would have known about this." And there's the FISA court issue and lots of other safeguards and checks here that can very persuasively and definitively rebut this kind of wild accusation. But it's not something, obviously, that he consulted his new national security advisor about, or any of his cabinet members, or anyone who knew Washington at all. And it's very interesting. Presidents in the past who have been in crisis, and I worked for two of them, Lyndon Johnson certainly was feeling a great sense of crisis during his final months in office over Vietnam and the popular revulsion and the literal unseating of him as the Democratic candidate in 1968. And then, of course, Richard Nixon, almost from the beginning of his term, the mounting political opposition to the war, and he was inundated by leaks. Much the same way that Donald Trump has been. Very different kinds of leaks. They were, I would say, much more serious and policy oriented than many of these have been. But nonetheless, he felt beleaguered and besieged. In those moments, presidents sometimes turn inward and sometimes display their pathologies a little more openly. But they often also reach out. We know that Lyndon Johnson had a habit of talking to his old friends on Capitol Hill. We know that Richard Nixon had friends in the private world, and we now know, too, that he talked to his family and to some extent with his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger. Trump seems to be doing none of that. This seems to be a very solitary agony that he is going through, and I think that makes it all the more worrisome. He's obviously not bouncing these things off anyone. He's not asking about the wisdom of accusing the former president of wiretapping him. He's not really checking on any of the possible rebuttals to that. So you have a man alone in the White House with an obvious pathology, and I think it's probably the most serious moment, Ian. Not to be too silly about this, but the most serious moment we've faced in the history of the American presidency. Given how much power Washington has to abuse, given the ignorance, the demagoguery, the authoritarian impulse, the corruption or worse in this administration and in the president himself, I think there is absolutely no moment like it in American history.
But calling Obama bad or sick, in parenthesis, guy, with an exclamation, not a question mark, that's pretty, that's a direct and extremely aggressive insult. So that's in itself seems unprecedented. And
well,
I don't,
well, it is. I mean, you were talking about earlier about the origins of the republic, and it was a very nasty and a tough political discourse and dialogue. But the worst of that in the early Federalist period and the Federalist Democratic rivalry and conflict, the worst of that was usually, of course, done by proxies. You had the yellow press, and you had all sorts of proxies out there saying things and doing things and making claims. We've never really had a sitting president of the United States, of course, with anything like this megaphone that he has in social media and in Twitter, saying this kind of thing about a sitting president or any other senior official in the U.S. government. I'm sure he's capable of saying this if he's already said it in part, of course, about Schumer, but capable of saying it about the leaders of his own party, if it should come to that. If and when, and I think it will come to that eventually, obviously, the Republican Party has to cut its ties, then he will turn with the same venom. But this is part of this pathological performance. We're not seeing anything that remotely has a parallel, because we've never really had this kind of illness in the Oval Office.
Well, it's certainly extraordinary. And in contrast, of course, it does look, and you mentioned this a minute ago, that General McMaster, the new National Security Advisor, is trying to bring some professionalism. I noticed that he's hiring Fiona Hill, who I know who's really very solid on Russia and has no illusions about Putin. So that's happening on the one hand. But in the broadest sense, to my mind, Trump is already Putin's bitch. He already owns him, because Putin has all the information, all the speculation about what went on with Russia. The person who really knows more than anybody and has all the secrets and may have incriminating videotape, etc., is Vladimir Putin. So when you're worried about compromise, which is what you worry about, that's why they do clearances for people to get them security clearances to find out whether there's any way that anybody can get to them and blackmail them. Well, my God, who's the one person in the world that seems to have all the goods on Trump?
Well, this is what we've said before, Ian, in talking about this, going back to last summer and autumn, well before the election. This has been a very serious, concerted, long-term Russian intelligence operation. It involves more than Donald Trump. It involves more than just the hacking of the Democratic National Committee or the intervention, blatant and outrageous as it was, in the 2016 election. This is a long-term effort to penetrate and to subvert the United States in a number of ways, and it's part of a very, very concerted and deep-seated hostility, which now lies at the heart of Russian policy toward the United States. One of the great tragedies in the history of geopolitics that has happened over the last 20, 25 years, when you consider what the possibilities were when the hammer and sickle came down from the staff on the Kremlin Tower.
Sure, and surely we have a lot to answer for on this side with the eastward expansion of NATO for no.
Oh, absolutely, which took place under both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and the first salvo, of course, was in by 1999 with Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Poland, but those were sort of the warning signs that were unheeded, that were ignored. The responsibility for this lies with those two administrations, essentially, and with the people who conducted foreign policy, and that of course includes Colin Powell and Madeleine Albright and the National Security Advisors and all the rest. But that's a history, as you may have noted, which we have strenuously avoided here in all of the to and fro about what has happened. I see this, the whole handling of this, of the Russian operation and the drip-drip, or the gush-gush, as it happens, of revelation, to have been one of the most discouraging episodes in the history of American politics, because this is arguably the most important, most significant attack on America since Pearl Harbor. And I don't count 9/11 in the same category. That was not delivered by a great power with nuclear tipped missiles and a different kind of attack, serious as it was. But this onslaught, which is long term and serious, as we just said, is an extremely significant moment. And what you've got here is an absolute impotence in response by the American political system. It was missed by the Democrats. Hillary's negligence here, the negligence of her people and her campaign in pursuing this when it first made its appearance in this late summer, is absolutely stunning. The media, as you and I have often commented, dealt with this totally without depth and without understanding, did not pursue it when it should have. Now you've got this spectacle of an absolutely craven Republican Party refusing to acknowledge even the seriousness of this attack, let alone conduct a conscientious investigation. I must say it's very, very discouraging. I'm not sure that even as this comes out further, and even if there is a kind of final reckoning for Donald Trump, that any of this public ignorance and distraction will much improve.
Well, Roger, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasions of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how Donald Trump fits into the global pantheon of dictators, despots, and authoritarians. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alastair Smith, who's a professor of politics at New York University. He has researched extensively on the nature of dictatorships and other forms of bad leadership and what can be done about them. His books include The Logic of Political Survival, Punishing the Prince, and The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. His latest book is The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alastair Smith.
Very happy to be here.
And obviously a lot of people have accused Donald Trump of having, shall we say, autocratic tendencies, and this murky relationship with Putin still has not been fully exposed. And of course now we hear that from the New York Times that the Obama administration wanted to get all of the material that they had out in terms of the secret intercepts, et cetera, get them dispersed within the intelligence community so that the new administration couldn't scrub everything, which is apparently what they've been trying to do, and put a lid on it. And then on top of that, one of the people that is a part of the Trump administration's firewall against exposing their ties to Russia, of course, is Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General. And his role is now being exposed in the cover-up, but also his role in actually being involved in with the Russians himself. So a lot happening here today, but let's focus on your book, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is almost Always Good Politics. Nobody has more bad behavior than Donald Trump.
Well, I think that the way you've characterized Donald Trump as if he's very special in terms of being a democratic leader who would like to be autocratic. I like to think that all leaders, once they have assumed power, they actually want to become beholden to less people. It's just the nature of the approach that Donald Trump is doing to this that really stands out as jarring because he's taken that populist route. So we're much more used to political leaders getting elected and then doing things like gerrymandering districts to keep their seats. We're used to them putting internal party rules to limit the competitors who can come up and challenge them. So we're used to those kind of rules. Donald Trump is trying a much more populist idea. You know, people keep harking back to Hitler. Hitler also blamed a large bunch of groups of people and used that as an excuse for taking away some of the democratic institutions of the Weimar Republic.
So, but beyond that, don't you think that Donald Trump, as a candidate, the reason he was able to, in a reality TV way, knock all of the other Republican candidates for presidency off the island in a kind of reality TV show, which is what the Republican primary debates became, he broke the mold of the normal kind of phony politesse that politicians use by really being outrageous, and they had no defense. So I think Trump has broken the mold, surely.
Well, he's taken the approach that got him there. I don't think that we should assume that this is the only kind of time this has been successful rhetoric. You know, Jefferson and Adams went at each other, you know, calling each other hermaphroditic and discussing the virtue of each other's wives and such things. This is not new. Trump was particularly successful at it, and I think in part because he found a way of tapping into a large portion of the United States who had felt like they've been left behind and ignored. And the reality is winning the Republican primary doesn't actually take that many votes. The turnout's relatively low. You only have to beat the next candidate up. And when you've got, like, you know, sort of more than 10 candidates running, you know, 15% of the vote is often enough to become in first and pick up on many, many of the seats. So lots of the rules are designed that the winning these early battles doesn't require a lot of votes. You know, this is how Congress survives so nicely, is that winning a Republican primary in a Republican seat only requires, you know, tens of thousands of votes in a low turnout primary, which is why, you know, things like gun lobbies are very powerful because they can promise the votes to keep these candidates in there. Trump exploited that. He got just enough people to knock out the candidates. And then he went on to run in the general election. You've talked to much, you in your introduction, we're talking very much about the bad behavior, his close relations with Putin. And you might sit there and think, well, this is terrible, but we might also think about it. If he had not had those close relationships, he probably wouldn't have actually succeeded in winning. We should remember that he lost the popular vote. He just scraped home in the beating Clinton in a couple of states without intelligence and help and some dubious reporting going on. He might not have got there. So the dirty tricks actually sort of worked for him. Now we're sitting there thinking, well, they're really going to cost him his office, all this dirty dealings with the Russians. But we should also think he wouldn't be in the position of having won but for the fact that he did these bad deeds in the first place.
And again, I'm speaking with Alistair Smith, who's a professor of politics at New York University. He has researched extensively on the nature of dictatorships and other forms of bad leadership and what can be done about them. His books include The Logic of Political Survival, Punishing the Prince, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics, and his latest book is The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. Well, but I think it gets back to what you've been writing about in terms of who these dictators are and what motivates them. And that's where I think, in this case, it's not just the collusion with Putin. I think in terms of Trump and Putin's relationship, I think there is a meeting of the minds, if you will, in the sense that both have contempt for democracy, both are only interested in power and money, which is clearly all that Trump is interested in, and both arguably are sociopaths.
I would agree with some of those things. I think that both Putin and Trump are interested in coming to power and have contempt for democracy. But I actually think that's relatively widespread around many, around nearly all politicians. The sociopathic element, I think, is not so widespread. But the idea that you want to come to power and stay in power is common to all political leaders. It's common to the heads of organizations, be they businesses or charities or clubs or whatever they are. People want to get to the top and stay there, and they adopt that kind of behavior. We're just seeing that in a particularly unpleasant way. Well, we should really, at the end of the day, draw real distinctions between what Putin does. Putin has political enemies assassinated and killed, bankrupted, locked in jail on sort of made-up, trumped-up corruption charges. Trump is not able to do that. As he's attempted to even adopt policies that people have, many masses have disliked, we're seeing that he's highly constrained by the press. People will turn up and protest. And the courts are highly independent. And unlike Russian courts that will go along with punishment of cronies, enemies of Putin, the courts in the U.S. Clearly show independence and are unwilling to go along. So I think Trump would love to emulate Putin's power, he has very little chance of doing so, particularly because all of the many, many people are out protesting.
Well, I think the fundamental difference is that in Putin's Russia, Putin is the capo di capo. He regulates. It's an organized crime state. And we've never had this phenomenon in geopolitics before where you basically have nuclear weapons and the mafia. You have national security and organized crime fused together in an administration. And that raises all kinds of extraordinary problems in terms of global stability. But that aside, the difference seems to be that what Putin's all about is maintaining power, regulating his cronies, the oligarchs, letting them steal, you know, within certain bounds. And basically, they all, him and the Siloviki, as they're called, basically just want to hold on to power to loot the country and enrich themselves. How much, though, do you think Trump is similar in that way? He's already got the power. He's put all these billionaires in, many of whom come from the extraction and flim-flam, scamming Wall Street kind of world. Are there similarities there? In other words, is the purpose of getting power to then enrich yourself or to do a job? And where are the lines in the Trump administration? How much does he really want to drain the swamp as opposed to enrich himself and his friends?
Well, there are real differences between how dictators behave. Some dictators actually just loot the economy. We can think of our Ferdinand Marcoses. Others want to ensure political power. We might think of people like Lenin and Stalin. There's no great evidence that they enriched themselves, you know, just stealing the whole of the state. But there's discretion that they have. A few leaders actually use the resources that sort of slack in the system to implement plans that they like, sometimes with great success, like Deng Xiaoping, sometimes with terrible success, like Mao. So all leaders want to come to power to get the discretion. I think Trump would very much like to emulate Putin, replace Congress and put in his cronies, diminish the power of the Parliament is very much a rubber stamp in Russia, and I'm sure Trump would like that, but it's virtually impossible for him to do so. We're already seeing that members of the Republican Congress are actually protesting and then starting to have serious concerns about Sessions and the fact that he may have lied to Congress, and they're pushing for an independent inquiry, independent prosecutor to look into these cases. So Congress is not a rubber stamp, and so far Congress has been, in some sense, quite compliant with going along with Trump because the Republicans are getting the kinds of policies that they've been looking for, but they're not willing to take away, they're not willing to go so far as to allow Trump to replace the power they have. And providing courts are independent, it's very difficult to see how he can actually do this.
So let's broaden the discussion out then, Alastair Smith, to a sort of into the full sort of global sphere. That my concern is that if Trump and Putin and Le Pen and Wilders and Orban are successful in creating a kind of global compact that's inherently illiberal, that is all about power and oligarchy, and the worst kind of scapegoating politics of racism, etc., which is certainly the case in Russia, it's certainly the case in Hungary, it's certainly the platform of Wilders in the Netherlands and Le Pen in France. If that is successful, I mean, you cannot make the assumption that democracy is inevitable. I mean, it has to be nurtured and protected. And I think people make the assumption that it is somehow inevitable, when I think, you know, it's really under attack. And I don't know that people on the left get it, and I certainly don't think people on the right get it.
Well, I think you've conflated two ideas. This is the difficulty of creating democracy and eroding democracy. So the U.S. is close to 250 years old now. There are long-established institutions. There is an independent judiciary. There's an independent press. And people are well aware of those rights. It seems that very few people have interests in allowing Trump to get away and erode the power of Congress to take away the rights of people to vote. So I don't see the U.S. as being in threat. Other states like Hungary are less well established. They don't have they don't have hundreds of years of independence of institutions. And unless people actually go out and protect their rights, then we're likely to see democracy undermined. So why, you know, the big reason Trump is unlikely to get away with making the U.S. into an autocracy is because people are out on the streets protesting. They're going to town halls. They're calling their congressmen. And congressmen realize that Trump's probably not going to win, so they're not going to go along with him. They're going to keep constraints on him. The judiciary has no interest in having themselves become a rubber stamp, so they are not going to go along with any kind of institutional moves that diminish democracy. Unfortunately, in other countries, it's become much harder. So we are seeing some gradual erosion in some institutions in Hungary. Hopefully, people, to stop this, you have to go out on the streets. You have to protest. You have to take those actions. We saw the great, I really was empowered by the fact that the Romanians went out on the streets and got rid of the government was trying to get rid of this anti-corruption law to say corruption was legal so long as it wasn't beyond a certain dollar amount. And the people protested and the government had to concede. That's how we prevent things from becoming non-democratic, is through a free press and through the actions of the people. So it's not inevitable that democracy will remain. It does require the people to actually participate and try and actually hold leaders to account.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if we can put this in the broader global context of how few democracies there are, and the idea that the few that there are, and it's true that I was conflating them, the fragile and new democracies with the more enduring ones like the United States. But for example, Xi Jinping, the leader in China, has rolled back any attempts at democratic reform in China. And basically what he's telling his own people is, look at these Americans. Look how chaotic their government is. Aren't we wonderful? We're doing so well economically, and you're building all these high-rises, and your standard of living is going up. So forget about democracy. That's one sort of cynical form of autocracy in China. And then you've got the more brutal forms like you have in Iran with the religious democracy, in Saudi Arabia, in North Korea with an appalling, ruthless autocracy. And then, of course, you know, Mugabe and all these other sleazy third world dictators. So if you look at the whole globe, it's a pretty sad state of affairs, is it not?
I couldn't agree with you more that there are not enough democracies. And this idea that the world will all become democratic, I find hard to believe. So you mentioned China. China is this country that's been growing economically. And what has been happening is people have become politically empowered. And the regime is faced with this choice of either relinquishing political power or cutting back on economic growth. As far as I can see, there's been a decided cutback in political freedoms, and economic growth seems to be slowing in China. This will be consistent with being a political leader. It's better to control a smaller pie and say who gets to eat than let the people feed themselves, because you have no political control once everybody feeds themselves. That's democracy. It's hard to keep your job. But let me turn to the question you've raised about why there are so few democracies. And I actually think whilst the rhetoric we use in the United States and Western Europe is that we want to create democracy around the world, this just generally tends to be false. The problem with other nations becoming democratic is that it's very hard to ask leaders in those countries to follow policies that you want, because they are constrained by what their people want. When they're beholden to very few people, you can ask them to do favors, policy favors, and pay them enough to buy off their supporters, and they'll do what you like. So I always think of this as the nature of economic aid. The U.S. hands over money. Countries adopt, particularly during the Cold War, for example, anti-communist stances, in which case we support sort of right-wing dictatorships. The people in general might be unhappy, but the supporters are very happy. And so it actually serves the U.S. interest. They get the policies they want, anti-communism, at a relatively cheap price, make those countries democratic, and it's very hard for the U.S. to be able to direct the policies of foreign nations. So there's always this tension between this sort of moral and ethical idea that we want other states to determine their future, but if we help empower the people in foreign nations, we have to face the inevitable that those people might choose things that we don't want. So often we want to keep nations autocratic and poor because then they're easy to buy. It's sort of one of the sad states of the world, but we have to look at U.S.'s attempt to democratize around the world through foreign aid since the end of World War II. It's been very unsuccessful in the vast number of countries.
Well, just in closing, of course, Equatorial Guinea would be the poster boy for what you just said, a tiny little country in Africa led by an incredibly vicious, corrupt family who exploit all the oil wealth, none of it trickles down, and the big global multinational oil companies are perfectly happy with that situation because they only have to pay off one family as opposed to a whole country.
Absolutely, and those countries stay poor because the leaders have the resources they need to pay off the army and pay off their supporters through oil revenues, or as I was just sort of describing, often through aid receipts that people receive. You don't need the people to do any work in those countries. Hence, those countries stay poor. People have low qualities of life. They have little opportunity to talk to each other because it's not in the interests of the leadership to promote education and welfare and communication and discourse, because that all threatens their control on power. So they don't produce those kinds of public goods. The countries that have been more successful in becoming democratic are countries that are actually resource poor and aren't getting things like aid, because then to raise revenues to pay people, governments actually have to have people do work they can tax. And people are very inefficient at working unless you let them talk to each other. So there's that big idea when we're thinking about the world, giving out money is a good way of stymieing the social development of a country and its political development that follows.
Well, Alistair Smith, I thank you very much for this very interesting conversation.
My pleasure. Glad to join you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alistair Smith, who's a professor of politics at New York University. He's researched extensively on the nature of dictatorships and other forms of bad leadership and what can be done about them. His books include The Logic of Political Survival, Punishing the Prince, The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics, and his latest book is The Spoils of War, Greed, Power, and the Conflicts That Made Our Greatest Presidents. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.